It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday, Dane County District Attorney Ishmael Ozan announced his decision not to charge Madison Police Officer Matt Kenny after a two-month investigation. In March, Officer Kenny shot and killed Tony Robinson, an unarmed 19-year-old African-American. Here is Ozan announcing his decision.
I conclude that this tragic and unfortunate death was the result of a lawful use of deadly police force, and that no charges should be brought against Officer Kenny in the death of Tony Robinson Jr.
Since that announcement, there have been peaceful protests and demonstrations around Madison. Today, the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition organized several protests called Blackout Wednesday and headed demonstrations in front of the Dane County Courthouse.
We're continuing our coverage of these events today with Andrea Irwin, Tony Robinson's mother, and Jerome Flowers, a friend of the family. Andrea, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
And Jerome, thanks for coming up here.
Thanks for having us.
Andrea, did you find out this announcement at the same time the rest of us did yesterday afternoon, or did you get did you hear from the DA in advance of that?
I found out that his decision was not to not indict in those exact words yesterday, as everyone else did. However, I was given the 48-hour notice of the decision on Mother's Day. And I was also given the impression of the non-indictments. I knew that it was going to be that when I got the 48-hour notice.
And when you actually heard the news yesterday afternoon, you had been expecting it, but what was your reaction to hear the reality that there wasn't going to be an indictment?
Well, after the statement that was read and the what was said as far as the statements of the boys, and it was a lot of not correct information. So by the time we got to the non-decision, I was very upset. So, and I ended up having to leave the room.
And Jerome, you've both been watching for the latest on the protest since you've got here. Did you just come over here from the protest going on in Madison?
No, we were not at the protest that is going on currently. We were taking care of some other things in regards to the case.
And what do you make of what you've seen of the protests so far today?
From what I know so far, you know, we encourage people to use their voice to exercise their frustration, their opinions, because this doesn't just impact the family, this impacts the community. It has shook and rocked the community in ways I don't think a lot of residents in Madison was prepared for.
Now, before getting back to the announcement yesterday, before announcing his decision or any of the facts even surrounding the case, Ozan laid out his own racial background and his experiences. Let's give a listen.
I am a man who understands the pain of unjustified profiling, and I am the first district attorney of color, not only in Dane County, but in the state of Wisconsin. I make note of this because it is through this lens that I approach and accept my leadership responsibility.
So that was a kind of the preamble before he got into the incident itself. Andrea, what did you make of that, talking about that to set it up?
Irrelevant. I just felt it was irrelevant. I mean, we all know that he is the first biracial district attorney. I just felt like it was laid out that like that to have a connection with the black community, but I mean that doesn't have anything to do with the fact of the decision that was made. If it was based on facts, then that has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I want to chime in. I agree that it was irrelevant, but I want to chime into the irony of it, because district attorney and the police department has minimized race in terms of the impact it had on Matt Kenny's decision to decide to shoot and kill Tony. So they've been trying to minimize the role that race has played in Kenny's decision. Then to turn around and use race and say, because of my race, that builds credibility for the DA that builds credibility for the DA to make his decision because of race. So you can't have it both ways. So not only was it highly irrelevant and, like I said, had nothing to do, but it was also, you know, also insult.
Talking to Tony Robinson's mother, Andrea Irwin, and Jerome Flowers, a friend to the family. Following up on that point, you said they're downplaying the issue of race in the decision, in the shooting, the decision to use lethal force here. Andrea, can you talk about that a little more?
Yeah, I mean, it's been said from the beginning that it's been, you know, they don't believe that Matt Kenny was, that when he shot my son because he was a black man, you know, they tried to base it on the whole facts of, you know, erratic behavior. And it's always been a non-issue of race, but trying to make sure that the people in the city don't get upset and keeping everything peaceful. And then, yeah, just like he said, you know, to turn around and then use an issue of race as a reason why people should trust your judgment to making a decision on Matt Kenny killing my son, which shouldn't be about race, you know, that's contradictory in and of itself.
And we heard in what the DA presented, and I think it's going to be coming out with information, Officer Kenny said he was worried. He said he was being attacked. He was worried that his gun would be taken, used against him, used against others. Do you see that as part of a reason, part of his state of mind in this incident?
Well, let me just say with the... That's a lot of thinking that happened in 20 seconds. And also the DA said for part of that, Kenny was unconscious. So it's hard for me to follow that logic. So the encounter only took 20 seconds before, you know, shots were fired in a duration. But in that, he was supposed to assess the home to see if there was anybody else in trouble. Struggle and scuffle with Tony, be knocked down. Then Tony try to grab that's I can't even explain that in 20 seconds, you know, the scenario in terms of what was supposed to happen in Kenny's testimony that all took place in 20 seconds for part of which he was unconscious for.
That said, though, it was a difficult moment, a difficult 20 seconds. He made a decision quickly. I don't want to try to psychoanalyze here too much. It was a tough position to be in, and he made a decision that that we regret the outcome of. But do you think, given all that, that there should be criminal charges?
Absolutely. First of all, we only know that that situation was a tough situation because of that's what Matt Kenny said. There is a point on the dash cam video where Matt Kenny disappears into the house. Those 20 seconds where all of the difficulties are at are not on video, not on audio, and it is only the word of a man who just fired 7 shots into a 19-year-old person's body. So that is to be left up to someone's opinions. And honestly, the forensics don't match what his statement is. We've got our own investigation that's been done, and the things that are what truth really is will end up coming out. But there's, you know, to be able to reenact what Matt Kenny said happened and put that all together and make it fit in a 20-second time frame, I don't think I could do it. I'd like to see if the police would do it, because I know they didn't.
Do you plan to file a civil suit?
Yes.
Do you have a time in mind? Is that going to happen soon, or are you still working on investigation and details right now?
We're working on the investigation. My lawyers are going over all of the paperwork. We're going over the autopsy report, and we don't have a timeline for that. There's no rush for anything. I want to make sure the one thing that is the most important to me is the accountability of Matt Kenny as far as him murdering my son. The civil suit is something that, you know, I could care less whether or not that doesn't happen for 15 years. I want the man to be able to have to sit and have to pay for what he's done to my child and not have to be able to go across and finish his life where my son's life is gone.
And so remember, just you know, deciding to pursue criminal charges doesn't mean Matt Kenny would have been guilty. It's just saying that there's a possibility that some could have happened. And given Kenny's history, you know, he's already had a killing on the job in a controversial manner. In the 2007 killing of Ronald Brandon, I believe, ex-wife Susan called in minutes before and radioed in to 911 dispatch that it was a fake gun. Two other officers arrived on the scene with Kenny, but neither decided their life was in danger and then to fire shots. And Kenny again arrived on the scene and within seconds fired fatal shots. So He also has an extensive history, you know, of excessive use of force. So when you're looking at those type of things, you have to keep that in mind when we're trying to say if something possibly could have happened given those circumstances.
We'll leave it there for now. Jerome, thanks for coming up today.
Thank you.
Andrea, thank you as well.
Thank you very much.
That was Andrea Irwin, Tony Robinson's mother, and Jerome Flowers, a friend of Tony Robinson's family, with us to talk about the Dane County District Attorney's decision not to charge the police officer who shot Robinson. As John Stewart prepares to ride off into the sunset, three of his writers are going on tour. Adam Lowett, Trayvon Free, and Matt Koff are hitting the road with a night of what they call political-ish comedy.
We caught up with them in the middle of a busy day in the lead-up to their night in Milwaukee on Sunday, May 17th. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Well, you guys are all writers on The Daily Show. Adam, you're the executive producer. What's an average day on the show like for you?
You know, it is coming in and trying to figure out what we want to talk about that day and what John wants to talk about that day. And there's emails going around and everyone's watching the news and reading the paper, but we really are just trying to craft, like, what is our take and then trying to articulate that for the rest of the day without driving ourselves crazy.
Well, you guys are looking for the juicy stuff, I take it, the stuff that has comedic legs to it. What kinds of stories fill you with glee?
Mostly police brutality stories for me.
Trayvon's black, by the way. You should know that. He's allowed to say that.
I mean, obviously
no,
that
I mean,
is.
I mean, it's whatever we find that personally makes us laugh, I think, or like we find interesting, and then we come together to decide if that's something that John is interested in or that we can find something in that we're all kind of excited about or find funny, I think.
Well, Trayvon, since you brought up police brutality, that is something that's in the news a lot, and it's not funny. So how do you deal with stories like that?
I feel like those stories, when we do them, are more or less about making jokes about that, the story itself, and more so commentating on why it keeps happening and what people are, how people respond to it.
Well, we've got election season 2016 coming up. Seems like that would be a high holiday for writers on The Daily Show. Who are you most looking forward to writing about?
Well, Lindsey Graham, I think, is going to be running. So, you know, we like running jokes for him in the voice of a Southern belle, you know, who's just, you know, is fainting from too much heat and is sipping a glass of lemonade.
Oh, with all due respect, the president does not care, for he is a cad and a scoundrel. Why, it's as plain as the alabaster tone of my creamy skin and as simple as my maid kicked in the head by a donkey.
Is there fresh stuff to do about Hillary? I mean, she's been around for a long time. Is that a candidate you're excited about, or do you feel like, oh, man, we've already done all our Hillary jokes?
I like her because I feel like I love, like, rooting for an underdog. You know, you're just not sure if she's going to get the nomination. So it's cool to see someone having such a hard time out there.
How do you guys go about writing your material? I know that's something you're talking about on your tour, how you actually, you know, write a joke. You're scouring the newspaper. So you've got Hillary. She's not an underdog. She's a huge candidate. How do you go about crafting material there?
It really is sort of like what Trayvon was saying, like just the things that inspire you and then try and find what's funny about that. And hopefully our upbringing was mildly tragic enough that we're damaged goods and find humor in weird things.
She stopped at a Chipotle in Ohio.
She had a chicken burrito bowl with black beans.
I believe she also got an iced tea.
She also ordered guac.
How many napkins? John Stewart, Associated Press, how many napkins did she take?
I bet it was three.
Could have been four. Tell me. Call yourselves a news network. How many napkins?
You know, there has been, I'm not to go too serious on you, but there has been some conversation about comedians being damaged people. You look at Robin Williams, there are a lot of opinion pieces out there saying that comedians are fundamentally sad people with dark things in their past, and it comes out as jokes. Is there something to that when you look at the collection of writers on The Daily Show?
we're all like good people here. I mean, we all have something about us that made us gravitate toward wanting to do comedy for a living or tell jokes for a living.
In the comedy world, we are an incredibly well-adjusted
right.
office.
Yeah.
We all like have been really, I think Trayvon, Matt, and I, and we have been doing stand-up for a long time and know a lot of comedians, and like working at The Daily Show is heavenly.
Because you guys are all better adjusted than your peers out there?
I think that's probably what sets us apart in a big way, which is we have a greater control over that darkness.
Well, the tour that you're bringing to Milwaukee, it's being billed as political-ish comedy. What are you gonna joke about?
I mean, I like to talk about politics and Hillary and ISIS and magic. Talk about magic a little bit. And,
yeah, I'm probably going to talk about Hillary. Hillary is my cat's name. but I have 20 minutes on Hillary.
Wow.
About an hour on Bob Uecker.
Well, that'll play to Wisconsin. Well, I want to wrap up. I want to ask you about Jon Stewart because, first of all, I can't believe he's leaving. It's hard to imagine that show without him, but I'm curious. What kind of boss is he?
The worst.
People always said that, you know, the host, like, you know, you carry a host on your shoulders, but I didn't know that was a literal thing that we had to do when we started working here.
He seems like an intense guy. Like, obviously, a very funny guy, but an intense guy. Would you say that he is more in the school of the teacher in the movie Whiplash, where he's beating you to bring out your greatness, or is he more like Mary Poppins?
I watched Whiplash and I got jealous. If only I had a boss as nice as that.
All right. Well, I wish you guys luck, and we look forward to having you in Wisconsin.
Hey, thanks so much.
All right. Thanks a lot. That was Daily Show executive producer Adam Lowitt with writers Matt Koff and Trayvon Free. They'll be in Milwaukee this Sunday, May 17th.
State park funding has been a hot topic in the latest Wisconsin state budget proposals. The Joint Finance Committee is asking the Department of Natural Resources to conduct a study about new funding options for parks without relying on tax dollars.
We have two guests to talk about this potential shift in state park funding. First up is Lee Berquist, an environmental reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Lee, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be back.
Where's the state budget right now when it comes to funding for state parks?
Well, last week, the Joint Finance Committee of the legislature modified Governor Walker's proposal for funding for the state parks. And and after their changes, it'll have to go before both the Assembly and the Senate before it becomes law. It's really in the legislative process right now, but with the Joint Finance Committee, they took actions that will mean in the future no tax dollars for the state park system. It'll have to rely on outside sources of funding and user fees.
Now, you said they modified it from the governor's proposal. Can you remind us what the governor proposed?
Well, it was basically the same concept. In both cases, both the governor and the legislature are really moving the state towards the user fees that the park system has always relied on, but not using any money from state tax dollars. The difference between the governor's proposal and the joint finance proposal is that the joint finance just increased some of the user fees a little bit more to make up for, they just shifted some money around and they just increased the user fees a little bit more.
Now, Republicans and Democrats have been at odds about these kind of user fee increases. What do both sides have to say about fee hikes?
Well, in this case, the Republicans say that we have to look at the situation where there's a high demand for many parks, especially some of the really popular parks like Peninsula Park or Devil's Lake, and where there's in the summer there's 90% plus occupancy rates of parking or of camping spots. And if there's so much demand, maybe we should increase the rates for that. In general, there's I think a philosophical approach by the Republicans that if people who are using the parks should pay more for them. The Democrats have a different point of view. They feel that the parks are more of a they view it more as a as something that the entire state should pay for with tax dollars, that it's a public good, and that you want to maintain your investment in them, and that they're fearful that if you raise the rates, raise the prices of fees to use the parks, that that some of residents will be priced out of using those.
Now, there could be other revenue streams options that will be considered, but in general, we're talking about the notion of a state park system that is self-funded by the parks themselves. Do we know if that idea has worked in other states?
Well, I think the short answer is it has not worked at this point. But let me just say that talking with the state parks director, Dan Schuler, and with others, there's clearly this is a trend that is moving in other states as well, that the sense that there needs to be some kind of a new way of financing parks, and one of those will be to look at other sources of revenue. But at this point, in other states, it hasn't worked.
And why hasn't it worked?
Well, the parks are expensive. You know, like we talked about Peninsula or Devil's Lake. I mean, if you just had to run those two parks, you could maybe run them off user fees. But you have parks and state trails all over the state, which have different levels of utilization. It costs a lot to keep those up. You need more personnel, oftentimes limited-term personnel in the summer to run those parks. And the other factor, which is kind of looming in the background, is just the huge infrastructure capital costs to maintain these facilities over the long run. In the case of Wisconsin, I think the 10-year capital needs that the Department of Natural Resources has outlined is about $285 million. So somewhere in all of this equation, you also have to figure out how to pay for, you know, the long-term maintenance of these facilities.
Now, a legislative committee asked the DNR to conduct a study to explore new revenue streams. What revenue streams are they talking about, other than public funding?
Well, I think you're going to just see more affiliations in some manner with private companies, with the state parks.
Are you talking about corporate sponsorship or underwriting?
Well, I think this is a little nebulous. Kathy Stepp, the DNR secretary, responding to a question from a lawmaker, brought up the idea or acknowledged that it's not something they're looking at right now, but naming rights was something that they had discussed, meaning within the DNR. That was in early March. Since that time, I've had repeated conversations with the agency, and they say there's no plans for quote-unquote naming rights. In other words, a certain state park would lose its name or have appended to its name the name of Menards or a public utility or something like that. I think, though, that in the future you may see something where maybe a trail would have the name of some entity, some private company, that helped to pay for the upkeep of that trail, or something where there would be some signage or some kind of a affiliation in that regard for some role that that business would play in maintaining that park. But I'm not sure, at least I'm not sure naming rights is going to be front and center at this point.
And Lee, just briefly as we wrap up, what do we know about how sustainable self-funding is for state parks, both short-term and long-term?
At this point, it hasn't proven to be sustainable. I'm not saying that might not change in the future. As people, I think as more people experiment, as more states experiment with this, but in looking at some research by the National Association of State Park Directors, they had indicated that there were 10 states that don't use any public dollars, any general purpose tax dollars at all to run their parks. But in place of that, they're using lottery proceeds, taxes that come from the sale of gas tax or other public sources like that. So they're not using general purpose tax dollars, but they're finding another revenue stream for the lottery or something like that in place of it.
Lee, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
That was Lee Berquist, environmental reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was with us to talk about removing tax dollars from state park funding.
And we're taking your calls on funding for state parks. What do you think about removing tax dollars from Wisconsin state park funding? How would you like to see us pay for those parks? Do you think this should be a priority for lawmakers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we'll talk to the president of the Friends of Wisconsin State Parks about these issues, and we'll take your calls. We're continuing our discussion about state park funding now with Bill Zager, the president of the Friends of Wisconsin State Parks.
And you can join in. How big a priority do you think state parks should be in Wisconsin's budget? What do you think of Governor Walker's idea to cut all public funding from parks and fund them in different ways? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Bill Zager joins us now to talk about the possibility of an end to state funding for state parks. He's the president of the Friends of Wisconsin State Parks. Bill, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Bill, what was your first reaction to the news that Governor Walker might cut public funding to state parks?
Well, anytime there's a change in funding streams, it is always a concern. And we had a lot of questions from our local friends groups, of which we have 82 friends groups. And our main concern is we do need a certain amount of money to keep the parks open for business, so that was our concern.
And some lawmakers have said those who use the parks should pay for the parks, and we have these fee increases on the table as one option. Other sources of revenue are being looked at as well. What do you think about moves like that to try to make the state parks more self-sufficient?
Well, it had been a lot of the fees hadn't been increased for 6 years, so that was something that our friends group was fully backing. It was for an annual, they went up like $5, which is not a huge strain on most budgets. And as far as the other revenue streams, there are other options on the table.
Let's go to some of our callers now. We have Mike with us from Wausau. Mike, hi.
Hi.
What do you think? What do you think about this?
Well, I think it's an absolutely shameful proposal. Wisconsin has a great tradition of considering the natural resources of our state as public, and the state is the trustee for the public. This just seems to be a move toward the whole concept of privatize, monetize, sell off the resources of our state. The whole point of a state park is that we have a responsibility as a state to preserve and to use resources wisely, and make them available to everybody. And as prices go up and up and up, then it becomes just another thing that only the wealthy can enjoy.
Mike, thanks a lot for your call. And Bill, what do you think about that? If prices go too high, if this becomes the primary revenue stream, is it going to become prohibitive for some people?
Well, yes, it could. If it continues to go up, it would definitely be a concern. And I guess that the increases that we had, and like I said, over the time period, we will see if this has an impact on sticker sales. But overall, it is still a good value. I mean, like the trail passes are $20 a year, and that's good for any trail in the state of Wisconsin right now, and it will go to $25. I don't have all the numbers right in front of me, but the state park pass will go up by a similar amount.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Mike. We're going to go next to Michael calling us from Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hi. I worked on a project recently about a proposed park in Chicago. It's called the Cap the Kennedy, basically putting a 17.5-acre park over the Kennedy Expressway in Chicago. And in doing research of similar parks around the country, we really learned that there are so many other ways to finance parks other than tax dollars. I know naming rights have been mentioned, but they're not just naming rights in terms of private entities like energy companies and corporations. There are individuals who are willing to give, you know, tens of millions of dollars in order to have their names attached to them, such as Clyde Warren Park in Dallas. And I think it's really important to improve the parks such that they create such an amenity that businesses around will want to be there and create some sort of business improvement district by increasing the taxes in a very specific area around the parks.
Okay, Michael, thank you for that. And Michael's saying that there are nuances to the idea of naming rights that the corporations and others would be interested in, and that there are specific ways to tax areas around the park. Are those options that are being looked at?
Last winter, three of us went from our Friends of Wisconsin State Parks, the first national Friends of Parks convention in San Francisco. And we talked to other people from other states, or people from 13 states there, and they had all different ideas. And some of theirs, they said that the way that, like California, they said that the corporations need the parks more than the parks need the corporations. And what I mean by that is that if you have a big supplier, REI, Cabela's, somebody like that, it's more advantageous for them to use that in their advertising that we support Wisconsin State Parks than it is for them to have a sign in our parks advertising their product. So that's one of the things that we've looked at. Our friends group is not against getting corporate dollars, but we are not in favor of putting corporate names on the Peninsula State Park.
And in terms of corporate sponsorship, what would be okay if you decided that that was an avenue that you wanted to support and pursue? What would be acceptable?
Okay, we have our Friends of Wisconsin State Parks have worked with corporations in the past, and I know ATC has been a supporter of Friends of Wisconsin State Parks, and they can use that in their advertising, but they do not necessarily get their name is on our website as a supporter, but we do not put their name front and center on something in the parks. But it is they are a corporate sponsor for Friends of Wisconsin State Parks.
We're going to go back to the phones now. We've got Brennan on the line in Milwaukee. Hi, Brennan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
So I guess, in short, I'm completely against the pulling of public tax dollars for the support of state parks. It's a public good that everybody should have access to. And while I understand that raising the cost of entry somewhat makes sense, I would caution that without a solid state funding every year, those rates could go up exponentially. Further, you know, what happens to the parks that don't pull their own weight? Do we just get rid of those?
All right, Brennan, thank you for calling. And what about that question? If there are some marquee parks that are very popular, maybe Peninsula State Park, Devil's Lake Park, and they draw a lot of attention, say, from corporations who have an interest there, what about the little ones who get left behind? Are you worried about a class system for the parks?
Well, I guess what I'd like to address, there's the two streams of money that we are concerned with. There's the general revenue funds, which were used for everyday bills, you might say, operating costs, of which is now going to be used out of a segregated account. So there will be monies available yet for this biennium. And then what also there are what they call stewardship funds, which are used for improvements in buildings, and many of our things were built back in World War II. There's a lot of maintenance needed. So that sort of thing is where a lot of money is going to be needed over the next years.
And do you feel that the ideas on the table, increasing fees for users in the park, maybe corporate sponsorship, maybe some iteration of naming rights, do you see that as being enough to offset the future maintenance costs that are needed 10 years down the road, say?
Well, I think that the user fees and such would have a good chance of handling operating costs. That could be viable. When it comes to the other things, proposal that for law, there is going to be, they want to set up a group which would be come up with a business plan, a strategic business plan for the state parks, and that is mandated in the law to be done by the end of 2016 by a DNR or a group that they comprise of people of what type of a business plan could go forward. And I guess for right now, I would say that is what our hope is that we could come up with a business plan, and because the monies need to be there. These properties are owned by us citizens of Wisconsin, and it is in everybody's best interest to keep them up so the users keep coming.
And we heard Lee Berquist saying that Wisconsin would be, you know, among the first to be in this sort of situation with simply user fees, depending on those, and maybe corporate sponsorship, that there isn't really a template for success for this so far. Does that concern you as you look at the Wisconsin State Park system going forward?
Yes, it does. It's one of those things. If you could come up with a business plan, it would be the first in the nation to, because the goal is to keep services and infrastructure at least at the level that we have now. Because we do it, like I said, we have a lot of older infrastructure that has been decaying. It's been well maintained, but any homeowner knows that if you've had something since the 1940s, 1950s, there are constant maintenance things. So, yes, it is a concern.
How optimistic are you about the future of Wisconsin State Parks at this point?
I'm sorry, what was that again?
How optimistic are you? Are you feeling right now about Wisconsin State Parks right now, the ability to fund them?
I am optimistic. For the next 2 years, we definitely have funding in place that will handle for the operating costs. And I'm hoping that when the stewardship dollars are talked about, they have dollars that would be for maintenance on buildings and potential expansion of properties that come available within state parks where for purchase. I'm hoping that those funds will be maintained.
Bill, thank you for joining us. That was Bill Zager, president of the Friends of Wisconsin State Parks. He was with us to talk about a possible end to public funding for state parks.